Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to the program. My guest today is Dan Hirsch, President of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a public interest organisation focused on nuclear matters. Dan played significant roles in shutting down the Hanford N reactor and with it, US plutonium production. The Department of Energy Santa Susana Field Laboratory, site of a partial meltdown, and the UCLA reactor. He was a major force in ending dumping of radioactive waste in the oceans, stopping the space nuclear component of the Star Wars program, requiring upgraded security against terrorists at US nuclear power plants, and reducing the use of weapons-grade uranium in research reactors. He also teaches nuclear policy at the University of California, Santa Cruz. Dan Hirsch, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Yes, it's a pleasure. Now, I want to know, Dan, because I've never asked you this. Incidentally, Dan and I are old friends. How did you get involved in the first place in this whole nuclear issue, Dan?
I was teaching at UCLA in 1979, and there was a reactor accident at Three Mile Island. Mm-hmm. And students associated with the Committee to Bridge the Gap and some of the students I was teaching wanted to do a research project about nuclear activities in Southern California. I assumed that there were none, none that had any trouble. And within a few weeks, they discovered ocean dumping sites for radioactive waste just off the coast, a partial nuclear meltdown at the Santa Susana facility that had been kept secret for a decade, and then to my great chagrin, that there was a nuclear reactor in the building next to where I was teaching, which was leaking radioactive gas, argon-41, at levels that were 250 times higher than the permissible concentration because they had miscalibrated their radiation monitors. Oh. The irony, of course, was that the most radioactive place on campus was the building I was teaching in because the air inlet for our building had been placed directly downwind of the reactor stack.
That'd be right.
And additionally, the students said, and turned out to be right, that they were storing five nuclear bombs worth of fresh weapons-grade uranium in a filing cabinet. So I discovered that all these issues, which seem far off, are actually very close at home.
Right on your doorstep.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about argon, Dan. What's its half-life? It's a noble gas. You'll have to explain that to the audience. What's its half-life?
Yeah, my memory is it's about 4 hours. It's been some years since I've looked at it, but they were producing it all the time.
Yeah.
It is a noble gas, produces a nice little gamma and beta exposure when you are immersed in it.
What does it decay to?
I don't remember.
No. Well,
I don't remember that the decay product was a particular concern. It was to be immersion in this constant cloud of the stuff.
Yes. And these noble gases are absorbed through the lung too, and they're very fat soluble. So they tend to deposit near the gonads in the fatty tissue of the abdomen and upper thighs. Anyway, we won't talk about that now. So when you discovered all these quite ghastly things, Dan, what were you impelled to do at that time?
Well, it's a funny story. My students decided to hold a press conference to announce what they had discovered about the UCLA reactor. My sole income was from teaching at UCLA at the time.
Yeah.
So I was not wild about this. I said, well, I'll help you behind the scenes, but you folks need to do the press conference. So when 10 cameras arrived from the news stations, the students got too scared to do the press conference. One of the students was off in the restroom throwing up the whole time. And so I ended up having to sit in for her. And then one of the reporters asked what we were going to do about it. And like an idiot at the suggestion of one of the students, I said, we'll intervene in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission relicensing proceeding.
Yeah.
And we did that. It took 5 years, and eventually the reactor was shut down, and it did have implications nationwide in trying to eliminate the use of weapons-grade uranium at the reactors. But We did that, and then we also were deeply involved in trying to close the Santa Susana facility, which had had that partial meltdown.
Yes, we'll get onto that in a minute. What? Why did they have five nuclear bombs worth of enriched uranium in a filing cabinet? What was that for, Dan?
Well, that was to refuel the reactor. They used 93% enriched fuel. This is pure bomb-grade material. And they had the level of security you would have at the campus bowling alley or barbershop. They just didn't take it seriously, even though the nuclear engineering department had numerous distinguished experts. And so there was this very sloppy security at the facility. But it was essentially the fresh load of fuel in case they ever needed to refuel.
But was it in fuel rods or was it in powdered form? How? What sort of form was it?
No, these were in flat plates.
Oh, flat
aluminum
plates.
Aluminum, uranium,
yeah.
Flat plates, what are called MTR-type fuel, and they would be readily, the uranium could be readily removed.
Okay, so that's number one success story for you and your students. Now tell us about Santa Susana. Where is it? What was the facility? Who was operating it? And what were they doing?
It is 20-plus miles from downtown Los Angeles.
North or south?
It is north.
Yeah.
It is on the Los Angeles and Ventura County boundary. When it was first established in the 1940s, it was in a relatively remote area. It was designed to do work that was too dangerous to do in populated areas, but over the decades, the population of Los Angeles mushroomed all around it. So now hundreds of thousands of people live very close to the site. They had about 10 nuclear reactors on the property, plus a plutonium fuel fabrication facility and a hot lab in which they cut up irradiated nuclear fuel shipped in from around the nation.
Good Lord.
Of the 10 reactors, at least four suffered serious accidents. None of them had a containment structure, the sort current reactors do, a dome to keep the radioactivity in. And one of those reactors in July of 1959 suffered a partial meltdown. About a third of the fuel experienced melting. And it, as I said, there was no way to keep the radioactivity inside the reactor, so they pumped the gases out of the reactor core into tanks and from those tanks into the environment. They kept the whole thing secret. About 6 weeks after the accident, they did issue a press release, embargoed for Saturday morning newspapers, one of the rules of trying to keep a story killed. But all the article said was that a single element had parted and that there was no evidence of unsafe operating conditions and no release of radioactivity. In fact, a third of the fuel was involved, not a single element. It had melted, not simply parted, and they had, were pumping the radioactive gases into the environment at the very moment they issued the press release. So they, it was kept secret for those 20 years, and then my students found records, old government reports with photographs of the melted fuel, and we obtained a film that the Atomic Energy Commission had made about cleaning up from the meltdown, because they said, although they didn't tell the public about the accident, they acknowledged that there would be more such accidents in the future of the nuclear enterprise and that workers should be trained how to recover the reactor after it has melted. So we were able to give the footage and the photographs and the records to the major television station in town and the Los Angeles Times. The television station ran it for a week, and it was the first time people had learned about a partial meltdown in
God,
L.A.
Good God. And, okay, so how large was the reactor? Was the Department of Energy running this enterprise? And what sort of isotopes, radioactive elements, were released from the meltdown, Dan?
Very good question. The reactor was started up in 1957, and it, as a kind of publicity stunt, the Atomic Energy Commission connected it to the electric power grid and let it run electricity to a town nearby called Moore Park, about 8,000 people at the time. And they brought in Edward R. Murrow, the Dean of American Television Journalism, to do a special hour show on his television show, See It Now, remarking about how great it is that the power of the atom can light a little a book for a little boy to read by. But less than 2 years later, the reactor suffered a severe accident, and the Atomic Energy Commission didn't get around to telling Edward R. Murrow that there might be a good follow-up story, Partial Meltdown in L.A. So it is viewed as the first reactor to produce commercial power for the electric grid in the United States. As I say, it had no containment structure. It was on the order of 20 megawatts thermal, so it was a little less than a hundredth the size of a big power plant.
Yep.
But because of the lack of a containment structure, some experts like Dr. Arjun Makajani estimate that it could have released up to 240 times as much radioactive iodine as was released from Three Mile Island.
Oh, good
the
God.
Official estimates of TMI.
Oh.
As to what got out, we really don't know, because the radioactive monitors, the radioactivity monitors, went off scale during the accident.
As happened at Three Mile Island.
Well, this was very, very severe. They took a sample from the gas storage tanks, and it was so radioactive that they couldn't get close enough to it to measure. The radiation monitors in the high bay went way off scale. Over and over again, the devices simply couldn't read radiation that was that high. So we, to this day, do not know well what got out.
Or how much?
What or how much, precisely. There was minimal, essentially no monitoring off-site. What we do know is the following, that the full facility, which, as I said, though, had other reactors and other nuclear enterprises on it, is heavily contaminated, with both with chemicals and with radioactivity.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, the U.S. government has already spent about $250 million of taxpayer money trying to clean up this contaminated site, and they really haven't even begun.
And what are the isotopes that are...
Oh, they're finding cesium and 137, yeah. strontium-90, plutonium-238 and 239,
oh.
tritium, there's a tritium plume in the groundwater that is five times the safe drinking water level, and fairly extensive. So it's the normal mix of radionuclides that you would expect, plus some plutonium because of the plutonium facility. Plutonium-238 is a little puzzling. It's possible that they were doing work on these space radioisotope thermal generators that use plutonium-238. But in addition, there is perchlorate and TCE and dioxin and PCBs.
Okay, you need to explain for the audience each of those isotopes, what they produce in the body, how long they last, and the perchlorates and... All the rest that you just described.
Strontium-90 has, and cesium-137 both have a half-life of approximately 30 years, which means they are considered dangerous for roughly 600 years or 20 half-lives.
And what do they do in the body?
Strontium-90 mimics calcium, so it concentrates first in the food chain and then in the body in bone. And in the bone, it can cause bone cancer or leukemia. As they say, concentrates, so if you have fallout of it on grass and then the cow eats the grass, it concentrates first in the grass and then in the cow and then in the milk and then in the bone of the person who drinks the milk.
And breast milk.
Right. Cesium-137 is a powerful gamma emitter. This is very penetrating radiation.
Like X-rays.
Higher energy X-rays.
Yeah.
And it will go into many parts of the body. Again, there's often long residency period within the body. The strontium will pretty much stay with you most of your life because the bone doesn't turn over very quickly. Cesium is so intense a emitter that they often use it for things like radiography or irradiating food, these huge, huge, huge doses. Tritium has a 12.3-year half-life. It is the radioactive form of hydrogen, and so it tends to form a radioactive molecule of water. In other words, it's not dissolved in the water like most radioactive materials. It is the water. It's H2O.
Tritiated water, yeah.
And therefore, you can't filter it out, unlike the other radioactive materials, which with considerable effort, you can filter. So tritium... has many risks associated with it. Of course, hydrogen is ubiquitous in the body, and therefore there is an exchange. change process whereby the radioactive isotope of hydrogen exchanges with a non-radioactive one and becomes a part of the molecule. So if that occurs in DNA and the hydrogen atom is a radioactive hydrogen, when it decays, it breaks that bond in the DNA, which can lead to genetic defects in offspring or cancer in the person who has occurred. 12.3-year half-life, therefore dangerous for about 250 years. The plutonium, 239, has a half-life of about 24,000 years. It's remarkable. It is amazingly devilish material, probably the most dangerous material on Earth for half a dozen different reasons. If it had a terribly long half-life, it would not decay very frequently, and therefore it would not be producing a lot of radiation now. It would last a long time. If it had a short half-life, it could cause damage now, but wouldn't last very long. But at 24,000 years, that means it's dangerous for about half a million years, and yet it's exceedingly toxic. 1/1,000th of an ounce will cause lung cancer if inhaled, with a virtual 100% statistical certainty. So at Nagasaki, the amount of nuclear material that brought down that city was about 6 kilograms of plutonium, and only 1 kilogram of that actually fissioned, and of that 1 kilogram, only about 1 gram, about a third the mass of a penny, actually was turned into energy.
Really?
It took down an entire city. If you took that one, that 6 kilograms of plutonium, that grapefruit-sized hit that brought down Nagasaki, and you were to divide it up and put a particle of it in the lung of every person in the United States, man, woman, and child, that would be sufficient, if one could do that, to cause a lung cancer in everybody
easily,
in the country.
Easily, yes.
So it's an amazingly toxic material.
Is there a lot
about as devilish as you can get.
Is there a lot of plutonium still scattered around in Nagasaki? I hadn't known that, Dan.
Well, there was 6 kilograms, 5 of which remained as plutonium that would have vaporized and gone off most likely as plutonium oxide, readily in a respirable form. And it lasts a very, very, very long time. And also, of course, it's not natural because it only has a 24,000-year half-life. Any that was created at the time of the creation of the Earth has long since decayed. So it is something that we make, and when we make something that's both toxic, long-lived, and incredibly dangerous in terms of proliferation.
You said it's a most dangerous substance for 6 reasons. So you've given the health aspect.
Well, the health reasons in terms of inhalation, although it's very dangerous if you ingest it as well. The main concerns with, and I may have given half a dozen as a poor estimate, but the main concerns are proliferation for plutonium. We produce in every nuclear power plant as it operates approximately a ton every 4 years, and therefore about 250 kilograms a year, enough for, say, 60 nuclear bombs per year. You can do it with much less. The work we've done at UC Santa Cruz suggests you can make a nuclear weapon with less than a kilogram. So we have hundreds of tons of separated plutonium that are available for proliferation, or the additional problem is terrorism. Can be used as a radiological dispersal device, a dirty bomb, just wrapping some high explosive around some plutonium could disperse it in a really horrible way, or a subnational group, potentially, certainly, nations that are currently non-nuclear, if they acquire plutonium, can acquire a nuclear bomb. So just for many, many different reasons. It's toxicity, it's longevity in terms of waste. You have to isolate it from the environment, they say, for 500,000 years, which is essentially impossible. Every place we put it, it migrates within a few decades. So we have a waste problem, we have a safety problem, we have a health problem, we have a proliferation and terrorism problem.
Yeah. So, okay, you were talking about perchlorates and other organic toxins.
Yeah, let's deal with those for a moment. Perchlorate is used as a component of solid rocket fuel. This Sanders Nevada facility, in addition to doing nuclear reactor work, also did a lot of nuclear missile testing, the MX missile, for example.
Really?
About 30,000 rocket tests were conducted.
30,000?
Yeah. And they would just wash the rocket engines out afterwards with TCE, an industrial solvent.
What's TCE?
Let that run, trichloroethylene.
Yeah.
Let it run into the soil where it migrated into the groundwater. And so there is a present at that facility 500,000 gallons of TCE in the groundwater, and it's considered unsafe at levels above 5 parts per billion. That's our maximum concentration.
And it's carcinogenic.
And has other effects as well, but yes. And the TCE, they were doing a pump and treat program to try to remove it from the groundwater, and they were getting 10 gallons per year removed. So at that rate of pumping, it would take 50,000 years of pumping. And, of course, it would take much longer than that because the recovery rate was dropping each year, and for the last decade, they decided to stop the pumping entirely.
Yep.
They also used perchlorate, as I said, as a solid rocket fuel component, and also for the nuclear reactor work.
Did they?
Perchlorate damages the thyroid function.
Yes.
And causes developmental problems in children.
And fetuses.
Right. It's a salt. And so it migrates very rapidly in surface water or groundwater. And we have found perchlorate in about a third of the water wells in the town of Simi Valley, which is very close to Santa Susana, to the field lab, and pretty clearly having gotten there by runoff of the perchlorate-contaminated soils, rainwater carrying this salt-like material down into Simi Valley, where it then percolates into the groundwater. Additionally, there are heavy metals, lead, mercury, a whole series of others, which have neurotoxin capabilities and other somatic injuries associated with them. And then materials like PCBs that had been used in electrical transformers, and lots and lots of dioxins, in part because the company had decided that runs the facility had decided
what company?
Well, it's now owned by Boeing.
Yeah.
Used to be owned by Rockwell International. Before that, North American Aviation. And so in the 50s, they decided that it was too much trouble to take the toxic materials off-site for proper disposal. So they dug a pit, an open-air pit on the property, and once a month would bring dozens and dozens of 55-gallon drums filled with these toxic materials. And then they would shoot at them.
What?
To ignite them. Yes, they would use rifles to shoot at them. And they sometimes it would cause it to ignite and fly high up in the air. And at one point, it basically crushed a pickup truck nearby. But when it would ignite, it would produce these huge plumes of smoke, of contamination, rising high into the air and then falling out all over the neighboring areas. They also did this with radioactively contaminated components.
I wondered that.
Most of the work that they did was on sodium-cooled reactors. Most reactors that people are familiar with use water for coolant, but there is a kind of reactor that uses liquid metal, sodium. And the sodium, anyone who remembers from high school chemistry, burns in the presence of air and explodes in the presence of water. Sodium-cooled reactors are very dangerous. So they would take sodium-contaminated components out of the reactors and place them in open pools of water and let them boil and bubble and burn in the open air for days or weeks with all that contamination, radioactive and chemical, falling out on the neighboring area.
Good God.
Yeah, so it was really quite a mess. It's 2,800 acres, and they operated it with impunity. They felt they were above the law, could do whatever they wanted for decades, and now we are faced with a terrible difficulty of trying to clean up the mess when there really is no such thing as actual cleanup. You can move contaminated soil from one place where people have a lot of exposure to a place where there is more isolation, but you don't really eliminate it. And our main problem right now, though, is that the Department of Energy and NASA, NASA has taken over responsibility from the Defense Department for cleanup of the rocket contaminated materials. Those two federal agencies, plus Boeing, the contractor that operates the facility for DOE and NASA and which owns much of the land, those three responsible parties have broken repeated promises to clean the site up consistent with our state law. 2 years ago, we got a law passed that requires strict cleanup of the site. And DOE and NASA are resisting, living up to their promise to clean it up. And last Friday, Boeing filed a lawsuit asking the court to stop the cleanup that's required by that law. If they are even marginally successful, they will delay the cleanup by perhaps a decade, increasing the exposures to the community for many years to come.
My guest today is Dan Hirsch, the president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a public interest organization focused on nuclear matters. At the moment, he is discussing the nuclear mess, I would say, at the Santa Susana Field Laboratory, which is now run by Boeing, but has been in operation for many decades. Dan, that you said there were 10 reactors there, I guess so, a small, but what specifically were those reactors being used for?
Well, your listeners will enjoy this, perhaps. These were part of the Power Development Program of the Atomic Energy Commission, designed to come up with new designs for nuclear power plants. You may remember that Admiral Rickover, when he was starting head of the nuclear navy for the United States,
yes,
and in some ways the founder of the entire nuclear power era, reactors that he was having designed to use in subs became the prototypes for the land-based power reactors. And most people remember the Nautilus, which was the first nuclear-powered submarine. What they don't remember is there was a second reactor built around the same time for a submarine called the Seawolf. And Rickover wanted to see which kind of reactor worked best, a water-cooled reactor or a sodium-cooled reactor. And anyone who's listening will immediately realize, which of course Rickover should have, that putting a sodium-cooled reactor in an underwater military vessel is not particularly bright.
Crazy.
If it came in contact with any water, there would be explosions.
Yeah.
And so there were little leaks and fires and explosions while they operated the Seawolf for about a year and a half. And by the way, do you know who was the first officer for the Seawolf before it went up? A man named Jimmy Carter.
Oh, that's right. Yes, I did know that. He worked with Rickover.
That's right. So Jimmy Carter was a senior officer for the Seawolf before it went to sea. Went to sea, had terrible troubles, and so after a year and a half, they discovered it made no sense, and they yanked the reactor vessel out of the submarine and dumped it as radioactive waste off the east coast of the United States.
And, the east coast.
Whereabouts?
Yeah,
off the Maryland-Delaware line, if I remember correctly, in a place called Sandy Hook.
Yeah.
And so while Carter was president, I don't know if he actually had anything personally to do with directing this, but while he was president, the Navy went out looking for this reactor vessel to try to monitor to see how much damage it was doing to the ocean by leaking radioactivity. It's three stories high, the largest piece of intentionally dumped radioactive waste in the ocean.
Really?
And our Navy couldn't find it.
God almighty.
So we couldn't locate it to determine how badly it was leaking. At any rate, sodium-cooled reactors were, and are again, I should say, spoken of with great glee
and awe
by nuclear activists because to breed plutonium in a reactor, to make more plutonium than you consume, requires the use of sodium as a coolant. So this facility was designed in testing sodium-cooled reactors, partially for the breeder reactor program, partially for other kinds of reactors, and partially for space reactors, reactors that would go into orbit and provide power for orbiting military satellites. Much larger versions of these were subsequently proposed during the Star Wars period to act as orbiting battle stations. So they built 10 reactors, virtually all of which used sodium as a coolant.
Oh, really?
And that's why they had so much of that sodium that they had to burn away in those open pits.
And that's why they had so many accidents.
Well, we've not done real well with water-cooled reactors either, but the sodium ones are particularly susceptible to accidents.
Well, tell us, Dan, because the nuclear power industry is mooting with great glee Generation 4 reactors, which are essentially fueled with 5 to 15 tons of plutonium and cooled with liquid sodium. Can you describe the worst-case accident that could occur at one of those reactors, Dan?
Yeah.
Go on.
It would be disastrous.
Tell us.
I should say that Edward Teller, who was no opponent of nuclear power, did say that breeder reactors made him petrified because, unlike a regular nuclear reactor, if a small portion of the core melted in a breeder reactor, it could reach a critical configuration that could blow up like an atomic bomb.
Yeah.
And then it could disperse the radioactivity,
the plutonium,
throughout the environment, not just plutonium, but all of the other radioactive materials that were in that reactor. So one of the problems with the sodium-cooled reactors is that they do have the potential for a quasi-nuclear explosion that you don't have with regular reactors. Secondly, they use sodium as a coolant. If air gets into the presence of a regular reactor, that's no problem. If you have air in the presence of sodium, it will burn or explode, and that would then cause a nuclear fire that would drive not just the volatile radioactive materials like iodine into the environment, but the particulates as well. A nuclear fire is about as bad as you can get. So the explosion could breach any containment structure, and the fire would then drive these radioactive materials into the environment. These reactors are designed primarily to breed plutonium, and plutonium is the last thing on Earth that we need more of. As I said, it takes only a few kilograms to make a nuclear weapon, and these breeder reactors were producing hundreds of kilograms a year. So they're disastrous ideas, and they're trying to make people think that somehow this is a way of addressing global warming.
And they can also blow up, as you said, with the nuclear explosion, scattering tons of plutonium to the four winds.
Yes, and imagine how attractive they would be to a terrorist.
Oh, yeah.
A, to steal some of that plutonium for weapons purposes, but B, if they could cause disruption of the reactor, it could cause much greater damage than from a traditional water-cooled power plant.
And the other point to note too, Dan, is its longevity. Half a million years, I mean, we'll all be dead soon in those terms.
You're not planning to live a half million years?
Well, go on, Dan. But can you extrapolate from us and our generation into the future if we really get going on these sodium-cooled fast breeder plutonium reactors? Can you extrapolate
what that would mean? The human beings have existed as a species for 1 to 200,000 years. We've had recorded history for less than 10,000 years. Your government, the government in Australia, the government in the United States have lasted a few hundred years. To be able to contemplate material that you have to keep from the human environment for 500,000 years is just beyond comprehension. These materials are of incredible toxicity and danger and incredible longevity. The other matter, though, is that we are in the period in which we currently live. I mean just these few years that we're in right now, are the moment in which the issues of global warming and proliferation will either begin to be solved or will become irretrievably beyond reach of solution. And wasting money on nuclear power plants takes money from the true solutions to global warming, solar, photovoltaic, solar thermal, wind, and
geothermal,
conservation, and so on. And so every $10 billion that we waste on a nuclear power plant is $10 billion that cannot go to something that would actually address the problem. So I fear that this little window of opportunity that we have is being wasted, and we will discover that we are, rather than solving the global warming problem, we're
making
it worse. Drown in global warming gases and plutonium.
Drown in global warming gases and plutonium. I say, out of the global warming frying pan into the nuclear fire.
Well, that's very well said. That's exactly our problem. And, Dante had several levels of hell, and the nuclear one is the worst. Global warming is just above it. And to have the nuclear people say, go down to my level of hell, is a way of getting out of the global warming hell is capricious beyond measure.
I'm interviewing today Dan Hirsch, who's the president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a public interest organisation focused on nuclear matters. Dan, can you postulate, as you know these people really well, you've debated with them and worked with them and had lawsuits against them, what is driving the people in the nuclear industry to take us into Dante's hell?
Oh, boy. I think that there are a whole series of factors, and most of them are a little bit beyond my ability to comprehend, even after all of these years of dealing with them. One is that the origin of the nuclear power enterprise is from the Manhattan Project and the development of the nuclear weapon. And we have never separated those two. There is something about the mindset of the people involved with nuclear power, which is also the same mindset as those who drove the nuclear bomb.
Which is what? Describe the mindset.
Well, I'll give you an example.
Yeah.
I had a friend who was head of security for the UCLA reactor. And he was a right-winger. His father ran the Richard M. Nixon Museum.
Yes.
He was a strong supporter of the National Rifle Association. When the day that Reagan was shot, I saw him running desperately to mail a letter. I said, "Why are you in such a rush?" He said, "I'm sending my contribution to the National Rifle Association in its hour of need," because he knew that the shooting of Reagan would revive calls for gun control. You know, this man was in charge of five bombs worth of bomb-grade uranium, and I had a conversation with him, and I said, "Why don't you want to convert this reactor to use low-enriched fuel that no one can steal and make a bomb out of?" And he had two reactions. One is he didn't believe you could make a nuclear weapon out of 93% enriched fuel. And his friend, who was standing next to him, who worked for an arms manufacturer, said, "Of course you can. That weapon's great. I've got a metal lathe back at the shop. If I had 5 kilograms of 93% enriched material, I could shape that into a nuclear bomb." And so this friend, the guy who was a security officer, said, "Well, I've got the key." So part of him was he didn't want to believe it could be used for weapons. He was purely ignorant about the matter. But when he learned, he joked. And what it came down to almost, I think, was a sense of macho.
Yeah.
That bomb-grade material is for men.
Yeah.
Real men. And don't take my bomb-grade material away from me. Like, don't take my guns away from me.
Yeah.
It's somehow the same kind of thing. The idea of a solar detector where you can get the energy free from the sun, you have no risk of terrorism, proliferation, long lives waste, all of that doesn't exist, doesn't seem manly to some of them. And at the same time, I also think they don't think you can make the kinds of money off of it. The sun is free.
But they're not making any money from nuclear power. The government
pays
for it all.
The government,
socialized.
The industry is going, as you know, to the Congress and demanding huge taxpayer subsidies.
At this point in time.
That's right. Usually, primarily in the form of loan guarantees, so there'd be zero risk for them, and that would be a massive profit center. Even if the reactor was never built, even if the reactor melted down, they still get their money.
Oh.
It is correct that the last time they tried this, they lost their shirt, but they don't remember very well the past.
Why did they lose their shirt?
Huge number of reactors ended up becoming being canceled before they could go into construction because of massive cost overruns. I'll give you examples from a couple that did open, but just here's the cost overrun. In Diablo Canyon, Units 1 and 2 were estimated to cost about a few $100 million. They ended up coming in at, I believe, $5.5 billion. And that's largely because of a whole series of mistakes that the people made. They refused to consider the possibility of an offshore earthquake fault, built the reactor on the presumption there was none, then the fault was discovered, they had to go back and retrofit it.
Mm.
And then, of course, everyone remembers that they built Unit 2 and Unit 1 to the mirror image blueprints, so when it came time to do the upgrades, they put all the pipe supports and whip restraints in the absolute wrong place because they'd used the mirror image blueprints. These kind of mistakes led to massive, massive cost overruns.
Mm.
So anyone who built one of these lost their shirt largely, and secondly, large numbers of them got canceled because they were so expensive and because also after Three Mile Island, there was so much concern about safety. So in the United States, there's not been a new reactor built, actually go into operation, that was ordered after, I believe, 1973.
Well, Dan,
very long period.
Dan Hirsch, how do you explain this present bout of nuclear psychosis then? How do you explain it, apart from the macho male testosterone factor? Because there are thousands or hundreds of thousands of people involved, including many members of Congress. How do you explain it? Including Dr. Chu, who's from Los Alamos, who's the energy secretary.
Well, including actually from the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory.
Yeah,
yes.
And including John Holdren, who is a brilliant guy, Obama's science advisor. He's sort of favoring, I think, Gen 4 reactors, including James Hansen, who's the Dean of Global Warming. He's a meteorologist. He favors Gen 4 reactors. What is this psychosis? It really is. What is it? Or why?
I think it is not so much just psychological as I think it is due to the corrupting power of money in our economic system.
Yeah.
People who want to build solar thermal facilities, these are the power towers with mirrors that end up, or these curved mirror system. They just use the power, heat of the sun. Mm. Or want to do photovoltaics. They do not have the tens of millions of dollars spread around Congress and to provide to presidential campaigns that does the nuclear industry.
The bribing.
I believe it's pure bribery.
Do you really?
We have the best government money can buy. The Nuclear Energy Institute and the utilities that are associated with it give huge amounts of money to congressional campaigns.
Yeah.
So I don't believe that it's an issue of belief. I don't think that a congressman gets up and says, I think we need nuclear power because she or he actually believes we need nuclear power. The majority of the people who are taking those positions are doing so because they want to get reelected, they need money to run the campaigns, and the money comes, Willie Sutton, when he was asked, why do you rob banks? Well, that's where the money is. Well, why do you support nuclear power?
That's where the money is.
Contributions are. And you'll remember that Obama
took a quarter of a million dollars,
a fair amount of money from the utility there, excellent. And Axelrod and numerous other members of the inner circle were tight with excellent as well. And you don't want, if you're a politician, to run the risk of some powerful interest group running ads in your district or your next campaign against you. So I think it has very little to do with the rationality of the
rationality.
I think it has to do with the money. Now, there are a couple of exceptions. You mentioned James Hansen.
Yep.
I'm a great admirer of what he has done on global warming.
Yep.
And you know that Hansen became quite famous when the Bush administration tried to muzzle him and tried to prevent him from speaking out publicly about the risk of global warming. Now, the most extraordinary blindness I have seen in science in recent years has to do with an open letter that James Hansen sent to Obama after the election. And in that open letter, Hansen said he had just returned from a workshop in Washington, D.C., sponsored by Westinghouse, builder of nuclear power plants. And he came away enthralled by the idea of Gen 4 reactors. And, okay, I mean, it's not his field. He should be more careful. He should read the National Academy of Sciences' critique of Gen 4, but okay. But then he took the most extraordinary step I've seen in a very long time. He urged the president to create as a litmus test for the appointment to any senior position in his administration support for nuclear power, and recommended to the president, urged him strenuously to bar from service the administration anyone who is skeptical about nuclear power. So James Hansen, the man who was gagged by the Bush administration, recommended to the Obama administration the imposition of a McCarthyite gag of his own, anyone who was a critic of nuclear power. And indeed, that's how you got Chu as Secretary of Energy, Holdren as the science advisor.
Oh, is that true? It's because of Hansen's letter to Obama?
Largely.
Really,
the
Dan?
The person who was said to be in the running for DOE secretary along with Chu, and Chu, we should just make clear for your audience, strong supporter of renewables. He did run a Department of Energy nuclear laboratory. he is an extremely rigid and energetic advocate for more nuclear power, including ending the 30-year moratorium we've had in this country on reprocessing.
Yes.
This was put in place by Carter and Ford because of the risk of proliferation from reprocessing. And he wants to lift that. He wants these breeder reactors. He wants more nuclear power.
Who was also in the running?
The person who was in the running was Dan Riker. Dan Riker is an official now at Google on their renewable energy work, but before that he had been an assistant secretary of energy at the Department of Energy and the chief of staff for the secretary, and before that had briefly been at the Natural Resource Defense Council as a lawyer on the contamination of the Department of Energy nuclear site. He was never a major critic of nuclear power. Probably now he in fact supports it some. But because of that past, that decades ago he had been with the NRDC raising questions about the DOE nuclear complex, and because of Hansen pushing that that be a disqualifier, we ended up with Chu, who really will go down in history, I think, as the person who knew better, who knew that we had to solve the global warming problem, but ended up embracing nukes.
Oh, God.
In a way that ends up with us getting neither a solution to global warming nor to proliferation. John Holdren, as you say, is a brilliant physicist, a very strong advocate also of renewable energy, but his entire career has been one of also supporting nuclear power. And so,
I asked him once, Dan, why he does, and he virtually said he has to keep a foot in both camps and be careful.
Well, I've known him for a long time, and I think that in large measure that is a politically calculated decision on his part rather than a scientific one. And the problem for us is we need science, not politics here, and particularly need that in the science advisor position. Now, I should say I think he's doing very good things on proliferation matters and on the renewables, but Obama ran for office saying he wanted at least to hear from all views. And yet he has permitted there to be a McCarthy-type gag in his administration on the nuclear matter. And I'll give you one other example, which to me is just astonishing. In 1974, the Atomic Energy Commission was split up into the Nuclear Regulatory Commission and a year or two later into the Department of Energy because AEC had a conflict of interest. It was both promoting nuclear matters and regulating them. The Congress split up those two functions. The primary nuclear promoter at the Department of Energy during the Bush administration and during the Clinton administration was a man named Bill Magwood. And Chu, Secretary Chu, pushed Obama to appoint Magwood to the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which has now done.
So
the nation's top nuclear promoter has now been named to the nation's Nuclear Regulatory Commission, where he is going to promote rather than regulate. And that, of course, is a recipe for disaster, because when you let the promotional desire get in the way of safety regulation, reactors melt down.
All right. So Obama's a very intelligent man. We all accept that. He is a lawyer and not a scientist or a nuclear engineer or a physicist or a clinician biologist. So, Dan, what do you think is driving him? Is it ignorance?
No, I think it's much more serious than that. I think Obama is, on the one hand, a gifted politician who can make lots of promises that elevate people's hope. But he does that in a cynical fashion to get votes.
And
once in office, he surrounds himself with the establishment he had vowed to change, but in fact, he brought directly into his cabinet. You see this with his economic appointees, his national security appointees, and his environmental appointees. They all are people from basically the positions that he claimed he was going to change. And so I think he felt that there was political cover by having the quote-unquote bad guys inside the tent rather than out. What he fails to understand then is that he can't get good advice and that these people are making 100,000 decisions every day, only one of which he learns about every month. And lastly, I think there's a strange passivity to Obama. He lets the Congress do what it will, and then when they've decided what they want to do, he helps round up a few votes at the end for what they've decided. There is no leadership. There's no going on national television and declaring the equivalent of, the moral equivalent of war.
Like FDR.
There's none of that. And look at the priorities. I don't think there's anything more important at the moment than global warming and proliferation.
Yep, I agree.
Yet he's expended his political capital on other issues. He's now having to essentially call off Copenhagen, saying, well, we'll postpone anything until next year because we can't get the Congress hasn't acted. He's not tried to get them to act. And he's letting his adversaries in Congress destroy the bill so that it can do nothing that really helps global warming at the same time that it exacerbates proliferation. I have come to believe that when historians, if there are any around, write up our era, they will clearly identify George Bush Jr. as the worst president in American history and one of the most negative forces in world history. He lost that opportunity to do something about global warming. He got us into Iraq. He triggered this global near depression, but most importantly, perhaps on the global warming side. And then Obama, I am concerned, will go down in history as the biggest disappointment. He came into office with tremendous public hope, and he could have converted that into real leadership that got us to directly deal with this global warming problem and to avoid a upsurge in proliferation. And I think he just wants a deal no matter what. He lets his opposition write them, and he exerts very little, if any, leadership, and he could do vastly better than that. We will end up, as I say, drowning in plutonium and carbon dioxide.
Oh, Jesus.
And I believe that historians will point to Bush and Obama as the people who presided over that window of opportunity, one person pushing us in the wrong direction, the second person failing to exert leadership to get us out.
Dan, do you think there's any hope that, this is just, for example, you and I could make an appointment to see President Obama? I mean, I know he hears from all the lobbyists and the corporations and Exelon and coal companies and the like, but I left a message for John Holdren, but it was, he never returned my call. I was in Washington. Do you think, A, there would be any hope that we could get to see him, and B, do you think it would make any difference?
Well, I know that you got in to see Reagan many years ago. I think it's always worth trying to do. I am troubled by the fact that it isn't happening already. And I don't mean you and me alone, but let me put it this way. In medieval courts, there was the court jester. There was someone who was there to basically warn the king or queen, if there were a queen, when they were engaged in activity that was going to be detrimental to their people or get them into trouble. They protected themselves by doing it through humor, but there was always a court jester. I have thought how surprising it is that the Obama administration does not have a community organizer, let us say, on staff in the White House, whose job it is to remind the president of that which he was elected to do and that which he claims are his values. Someone represents the ethical voice so that when all these generals are urging us to escalate in Afghanistan, there's someone who can remind them about what the Vietnam War was about. The nuclear industry is urging him to give them huge goodies in order to get a climate bill passed. There'll be someone who will remind him that that will proliferate nuclear weapons and can cause the world to eventually
blow up
in a nuclear war, blow up. And an economist who can remind him that you need to not be thinking of Wall Street primarily, but think about the people who are suffering. I am struck that a man who is African-American has had so little to say about the problems of poverty in this country. So I just wish there were access, not simply by the health insurance industry and the drug industry and all those others,
and but the plutonium
victims,
industry.
The representative of the victims and the people who see more clearly.
Yes.
I don't believe he's getting anything like an even-handed set of choices.
Yeah.
If you look at the economic issues, Larry Summers and Geithner and the Fed chief were all people who got us into this mess.
Yes.
And there's
Goldman
not a
Sachs.
Progressive economist on board to be able to provide even a counter voice. If you look at the national security side, his national security advisor is General Jones, who was McCain's advisor. The Secretary of State, Clinton, of course, has supported the war in Iraq. And you go down all of his national security team, they all took the opposite position that he had taken on Iraq, which is how he got elected.
Yes, it is very
clear. So now
clear.
He's stuck because he's getting advice only from one side. So I wish there were access.
Yeah.
I think it would be important not just for what the country does, but actually for his own political survival.
Yes.
Because I think he'd get into trouble.
Yes, and particularly he has those two little gorgeous daughters that he obviously cares so deeply about. Well, look, unfortunately, Dan, because I think we could talk for hours, and you've given us some fascinating insights into the dynamics behind drowning in CO2 and plutonium in the future. We'll keep working, obviously, but thanks so much, Dan, for the interview today.
If people are interested, our website is www.committeetobridgethegap.org.
And can
Thank
they
you
look,
so much, Helen.
And look, can they look up the history of Santa Susana and the number of reactors there and the pollution and the like? Can they look that up on your website?
Yes. There is testimony I gave to the United States Senate last year that gives that history very easily, and it's on the web.
Good. Website. Excellent. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. My guest on If You Love This Planet today was Dan Hirsch, president of the Committee to Bridge the Gap, a public interest organization focused on nuclear matters. For more information, go to Dan's website at www.committeetobridgethegap.org. www.committeetobridgethegap.org. And for more information on this radio show, If You Love This Planet, you can go to our website and download other fascinating interviews at ifyoulovethisplanet.org, and you can also contribute some money if you would like us to keep going. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll talk to you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.